Hello, everybody, and welcome to the debut episode of Aiga Night, two amateur film scholars' journey through the wonderful and wild world of Japanese cinema. I am your co-host, Chris Luciantonio, and join with me, as always,
is Aruba Kershid, who actually pronounces Aiga Night kind of correctly, unless, you know.
Okay, now you're just rubbing it in my face.
I mean,
do you want to start tensions on the first episode?
I mean, they got to know our dynamic right now, Chris. They got to know the dynamic right now.
All right. And yeah, Ruba, I guess we are finally doing this. We're turning our passion for Japanese cinema into something productive for once.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who the heck is going to actually listen to this, but at the very least, we can kind of screw around with some academic freedom here, so.
Exactly. We don't have to have the grades just held over us in the future, just kind of like looming there. But we can just actually be free and lean into our love here.
No essay grades on grammar, professor.
Exactly. So I guess we should just go into who we are and why we think we're qualified. We're not qualified at all.
We really are not.
We are two university graduates who have film degrees, film studies degrees, and we have cultivated lifelong loves of Japanese cinema in all its forms and just really want to spread the gospel.
Exactly, and we personally think that by allowing ourselves to really kind of enhance our opportunities to grow. For example, Chris is going into his master's program at York, and meanwhile, I do want to pursue my PhD at some point before the age of 50 in this field.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So this would be a nice, you know, startup for us.
Exactly. It's just a way to get all this enthusiasm out of our system before we have to really get beaten down by the academic world.
Exactly. And plus, our friends keep telling us to STFU maybe 40 times a day whenever we talk about this crap, so might as well have a platform where we're not told STFU to our face.
Exactly. They will learn that they are the wrong ones.
Yes. You can say STFU all you want at the recording. It ain't gonna stop us.
Yeah, because you are on a weird no swearing thing where you want to keep us clean.
I mean, more power to, like, I believe in the Japanese art form of discipline.
okay, hold on. You know what? Let's get into the movie we're talking about today.
Yeah, before we go into, like, Japanese culture and whatnot, but,
Hopefully it would all come up,
but do you want to talk about our, like, Japanese credentials?
I am a fan, that's my credential.
Indeed, and how long have you been a fan for, Chris?
Oh, since, like, the tender age of 14, I'd say, when I saw my first Japanese film, which I believe at the time was Rashomon, and had my mind absolutely blown by what films could be when viewed through another, like, culture's lens like that.
Right. That's amazing. I haven't seen Rashomon.
Oh, it's going to come up on the podcast.
It will. So. Now I will be. I, on the other hand, I have been in love with Japanese culture since maybe the age of 6. I have actually been studying Japanese for about 15 years, almost 16 now. So it is one of the languages I am actually fluent in, which, side note, is a lot. And I actually became fluent in Japanese because of my love for Japanese media. It did start with Dragon Ball, I will admit.
I mean, you gotta start somewhere, and, like, that's a great place
to
come in.
You do gotta start. Exactly. It did. I mean, if not for the love of Dragon Ball, I would not be where I am today, and I would not have this whole array of media, Japanese media, under my brain, if that makes sense. Like, now I have enjoyed so much Japanese media thanks to the development of learning the language that I feel whole. I don't feel suicidal.
we have to start somewhere with this kind of love, because we all have our entry points into the culture and into the medium or into the style of film that we are talking about, and then if it really clicks with us, we just keep going along that line and seeing where it takes us. Like, now I am searching these websites posting these raw Japanese movies that people in Japan are just ripping from the theaters, and I can't understand a word of it, but hey, I'm still watching them.
Right. And you don't even have to understand. Like, you don't even have to understand at first. It's all about consistency, it's all about passion, and it's all about enjoying it.
Exactly. So, I think without further ado, I will set the stage for the episode today and the subject matter.
Please do.
At the dawn of the millennium.
Oh, dear God.
Civilization collapsed. At 15% unemployment, 10 million were out of work. 800,000 students boycotted school. The adults lost confidence, and fearing the youth, eventually passed the Millennium Educational Reform Act 5. But you know, it's better known as Battle Royale. Yes, today we are discussing 2000's Battle Royale, directed by Kinji Fukasaku, based on the novel by...
Koshin Takami. Takami Koshin.
That was released a year earlier. Aruba.
Yes.
Can you remember the first time that you saw Battle Royale?
I do. So, actually, I did end up reading the book first before anything.
Yes, you are a purist when it comes to that. You always try and read the novel or source material first, right?
Most of the time, yes. Unless the movie has quite a bit of reviews. But I did end up reading... Battle Royale was actually the first novel I read in Japanese. Completely in Japanese. And that was kind of my graduating moment. Like, oh, look, I can do this now. But I also read it in English, you know, because it's my first language and I really fully wanted to understand it as well. So, I actually bought the Hunger Games... I bought the Hunger Games novels with it because this was around the time where Hunger Games was coming out. And I was like, I'm pretty sure there's a story that's exactly the same concept in Japanese, right?
So, and we might get into that later. That's a controversial topic of who came out first, who ripped off who. And it's a whole mess that people are really passionate about for some reason.
But it's quite obvious.
Yeah, and I just really want to like stick with the film here, talking about it, and not give young adult literature any more spotlight than it needs.
Exactly. But the book itself, it is a masterpiece. It twisted my soul. I felt like I could not put this down. I was reading it on the bus. I was reading it in school. I was reading it everywhere. And it really brought out like some psychological questions that I would never have thought of while reading. Now, of course, with the, because it takes maybe a couple weeks to read a novel and it only takes about 2 hours to watch the film, obviously when I watched the film right after reading the book, I was a little underwhelmed. And this was back in 2010, so I'm not going to say my age, but I was younger than what I am now.
But at the same time, like, that's a lens that we really shouldn't be seeing the film through of, like, how did the adaptation hold up? Because it's a different medium that we're getting into.
Exactly, and that really brought up, that's what I was really thinking about when I rewatched it now, back in 2018, because... Now a lot of my knowledge from the book is, I'm now detached from the book, and I'm able to appreciate the actual film as a film itself, because, you know...
What a film it is.
Yeah. It was still able to twist my emotions, get me attached to certain students, get me attached to their backstories. It just had to be condensed. It's only 2 hours long, right? So
it's a very tight thriller. Yeah, use every minute to their advantage, because they have a lot to cover. And
now, Chris, were you watching the special edition?
I was, yeah, because that's the only one that's really widely available.
Yes, okay, so we both watched the same edition. So I'm assuming for the theatrical release that a lot had been cut out at first.
With the theatrical release, when it was first put into theaters, it was taken out soon after for additional scenes to be filmed for it. Yeah, to add some backstory, because a lot of it wasn't playing on screen as they had. You know, we should probably describe the plot of Battle Royale for those not in the know. So it takes place in a dystopic vision of Japan, where, if you can't tell from the intro text, things aren't going great.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is there is the Battle Royale Act, which every year a class of students is uprooted and placed in an isolated location, usually on an island, to battle to the death.
Yeah, and their only way of surviving is to basically kill the F out of each other.
Yeah, because there's a 3-day waiting period on the idea of the game, and if there's not one person left standing by the end of those 3 days, their collars around these students' necks, they detonate, so no one's a winner. And just from that description alone, you can tell this movie kind of writes itself.
It does indeed, and paired with the graphics, paired with what I like to call the kill choreography. I'm a dancer, I'm just going to refer to choreography. And
makes it sound much classier than it is.
I mean, in a way it's choreography, I'd like to say, but and also paired with like really provocative and taboo subjects. You know, the film is able to like twist you, like you're able to enjoy the film on its own without having read the book, but the book itself is also that kind of a masterpiece as well, where you can enjoy it separate from the film. You will know what happens, but you'll still be able to enjoy it because it delves a little bit deeper into every single student's backstory a little bit more so.
Yeah, and we should like talk about that right away. The thing about this film is it has 42 main characters to keep track of. They are all important to the plot, because unless every single one of these students, 21 men, 21 female, are taken care of, then the plot can't happen and they would all die. So it is a thriller that, with the circumstances, puts all of these characters together, jumbles them together, and says, survive on this island.
Right. It's a little bit easier to keep track of these students in the book as well, just because I have the book right here. We have a student list at the very beginning, and then, like the movie, there's also a kill count in between every scene. So at the end of every chapter, we have 42 students remaining, you know, 38 students remaining. It tells us how many students we're able to cross off this list as well.
That's the amazing thing about this movie, is how it gets you to feel, like you were saying, it gets you to feel for every one of these students. They're not just a number. They're not just a count. They have a name. They have a trajectory. They have a story. And the way that Fukasaka, the director, gets you to care for them, especially with that text on screen where it shows the countdown of all the deaths, mm-hmm. like that's a holdover from his earlier career in Yakuza films. He would use the same thing, tertiary text on screen to show you characters' rank, their affiliation, and things.
Okay.
So yeah, like he's using that to great effect to get you to care about these students without really needing to have a background, because you know, as like you're gleefully watching them get cut down, murdered, gunned down, they have a name, they have a number, and they have a life attached to them, and that's really effective.
Now, with you watching Fukusaku's previous works, I actually have not. But did he use the same kind of dialogue on text, kind of split screen? What's the word I'm looking for? Like the dialogue on the screen for the most important pieces of dialogue for us to, like, for example, I have one here. Can you really kill me with that gun? And the dialogue is displayed in traditional Japanese text on the screen. Did he ever do that in his other films as well, or?
There are some experiments here and there with working with text on screen, like I was saying, not just for plot details and things of that nature, but he does have like those kind of stylistic title cards here or there, just to like really experiment with, because throughout his career, like back in the 1960s when he really came to prominence, working at Toei, making these Ninkyo Aiga, the very casual Yakuza genre films.
Eiga, bro.
Eiga, sorry. I'll Eiga. Get it eventually.
Eiga.
I only ever read it in textbooks, God.
My bad.
So, yeah, but working in that atmosphere, he was allowed to experiment a lot. So you see a lot of these radical ideas and interesting ways of approaching filmmaking that were afforded to him at that stage. So, yeah, there are instances, like, throughout his career, like, like I said before we started recording, like, Battle Royale is his last film.
Yeah.
This was an 80-year-old director doing a film about middle school children and just nailing it completely. Their psychology, the way they would react to the scenario. The script itself comes from is a collaboration with his son, Kenta Fukasaku, who was mm-hmm. obviously younger. But just that idea for, like, an 80-year-old just to get yeah. kids this hard. Like, mm-hmm. that's incredible alone.
Now, I was shocked when you told me this was his last film and that he had, like, he had prominence in the 60s. Now, he's back here 40 years later, not only attempting a film about middle school students, but he has a diverse female cast, which he's able to kind of bring that kind of badassery in Yakuza films within them as well.
Oh, yeah, like, we'll get into the characters, obviously, but Mitsuko would not be out of place in one of the Yakuza films that he made in the 60s as, like, a... I guess, at that time, it would be a prostitute character, but, yeah, he brought a lot to this, considering, like, his pedigree and the 40 years between, essentially starting the Yakuza genre back in the 60s with films like Battles Without Honor and Humility, Cops versus Thugs. I could go on. He was a phenomenal director.
And Kitano was there for a lot of that as well, was he not?
Sorry, who?
Kitano.
Oh, no, he wasn't there in with him. The reason why, like, we should say Takeshi Kitano, director, actor, superstar, Japanese personality.
Having
forever.
The character... Having basically giving that facilitator character an actual story, which the book kind of failed to do.
Exactly, but he's essentially just playing Takeshi Kitano.
Yes, he really is.
Yeah, that came about, because we should get into it, this was after the fact of the collapse of the studio system, and films weren't getting made unless they had a big star vehicle. If they were a big star vehicle, they had, like, a big name attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Kitano was that name because Fukasaka and him had like a connection and relationship. Kinji Fukasaka was originally going to direct what's that one film? It's it was Kitano's debut feature.
Zatoichi?
No, not Zatoichi. That was 2003. This was back in 1989.
Probably would not know.
Yeah, it'll come to me late.
Wikipedia. Ha ha.
Yeah, might as well. Yeah, but Kinji Fukasaka was originally supposed to direct that, and then because of the illness, which eventually claimed his life after the making Battle Royale, he dropped out, and that afforded Kitano to take over. Violent Cop. I was going to say Outrage Cop, but Outrage is a different thing that he made. But yeah, he essentially gave Kitano his directorial debut, and there's no evidence at all to back this up, but I'd like to imagine that this is Kitano repaying the favor. I like to imagine them as buddies.
Aww, little bro-bros.
Exactly. That'd be nice, right?
I know. Can we just imagine them, like, having little tea parties together and...
No.
I do. Okay? Don't ruin that for me. You cannot take that away from me, Chris.
Oh, I can take whatever I want. So, yeah, so Kitano's in this film as the teacher of the students who was fired, who quit, rather, after they continually rebelled against him and slashed his ass open.
Yep.
And so he returns to run the game for the JSDF, the Japanese Self-Defense Force, who is in charge of the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring him in as, like, the caretaker for all these kids, and he just uses it as an opportunity to get back at them.
Yeah, basically he behaves like he's the best thing in the world for them, even though he knows he's killing the fudgery out of them. Like, he knows that they're gonna basically beat the fudge out of each other. And yet, he behaves like this little enthusiastic middle schooler, basically. He behaves as if he relates to them, but he knows that they're not relating to him. In kind of an ironic, the character choice itself, because, like, the facilitator barely has a role within, like, once again, the book, but because of Kitano's star power, he's able to create the character of the facilitator just by being him alone.
Yeah, he's such a menacing presence in this, because he just shows such a disregard for their safety and well-being, mm-hmm. all while, like, gleefully going, like, through the motions of that role, because... as the role, he's supposed to inform all the students about the safety zones on the island to ensure that they come into contact with each other. The game itself is set up where the island that they're stuck on, every now and then, a danger zone will be put into place where if you're caught in it, your collar just explodes.
Yeah, and it's chilling because he goes ahead and kills one of the students and he's like, oops, sorry, I wasn't supposed to do that. Whoops.
Right away. He shows that he's not playing around.
Spoiler alert, guys, by the way.
No spoiler alerts. We are talking about the movie.
I know, but I mean, if you didn't watch it beforehand, your own fault, so.
He's like the extreme version of a disciplinarian because he kills the one student, whose name I'm blanking on even though I've got the list in front of me, just because she was talking. during the information video that they were screening for them.
She was whispering, if anything. I didn't hear her.
Exactly, yeah. He just stands up and throws a dagger in her forehead just to show that, no, we're not kidding around. You have to kill each other, guys.
What was her name? It wasn't Satomi? No. I think Satomi was with Kayako. I don't know. Okay.
There are 42 of them. It's okay if we don't get them right all the time.
Especially, like, and this is where we have our first glimpse of what I like to call the kill choreography, which, before I actually get into, can we actually talk about the under 15 rating?
Yes, we should. When this film was originally released in Japan, it received an R15 from the IRIN, which is the Japanese equivalent of the ratings board here in Canada and the United States. So yeah, you could not go see the film if you were the same age as the people on screen.
Yes, that which was ironic. It was a film about them, yet they could not, as a middle schooler, you weren't allowed to see it. Anybody middle school and under, not allowed.
Yeah, we're seeing that, like, even today, I believe Bo Burnham's 8th grade.
Yes.
It's, like, it's rated for, like, you know, people who have already graduated from 8th grade. So the people who it could connect to the most aren't able to see it.
Exactly. And I do think, like, the addition of this rating, because, like, the rating in the beginning of the special edition was quite serious. It had a tone where parents were advised to speak about their, like, to speak to their children during the home viewings about the content, which, I mean, in comparison to the content that is released normally in Japan, you know, you would expect this kind of warning to be very, very common, but here it was a little bit chilling for me.
Yeah, like, even the special edition we watch makes fun of that because it shows the R15 rating and then smashes it in the opening.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show, like, yeah, we're going there.
Yeah. Watch out, bitches! Oh, that's not a swear, right?
Kind of. But anyway, as a hilarious side note, actually, when he was originally doing the press for Battle Royale after the R15 rating, in a very, like, Spike Lee move, he advised people Kenji Fukasaka.
Okay.
Like, during the press conferences, he said, like, hey, kids, if you're listening, sneak into the film. It could really help you.
Oh.
Just like how Spike Lee, during the promotions for Malcolm X, he told everyone, kids, cut class, go see my movie. You'll learn more there than you're going to learn in school.
I mean, right? And it actually, there is a line in the film where there's, I believe it's Kawada, who talks about how he, because of this program, this kill every, like, Battle Royale program, he was able to learn things that he wasn't able to learn in school.
Which is a sad realization, yeah. Because you don't need to know how to use a shotgun, man. Like,
well, he did. He was cooking for them, like, poor little baby boobaloo. But
yeah, that's a great running joke, though, how he keeps saying, like, yeah, my father was a cook, or my father was a sailor, my father was a doctor. That's because, like, yeah, like, I teach myself, but I don't care.
Yeah. So, quite ironic with this R15 rating, but like I was saying in the beginning, the kill choreography is what kind of brings it all together, and you realize, oh, I probably would have been quite traumatized viewing a lot of this graphicness at 13 to 15 years old.
Yeah, it's a very effective shock to the senses, because Fukasaka's a very frenetic director. This is like a holdover from his Yakuza career, where, like, a lot of this cinematography style, handheld franticness, it was fully on display back then, but back then, you know, he was filming Yakuza subplots, so it had a more suitable subject matter, I would say, than this film. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you feel every kind of kill, because it's the way that he shoots it, frames it, and composes it.
Starting with the teachers, we don't see the teacher get killed, but we see his nasty body.
Yeah, like, they have, again, going back to that classroom scene, it's like, we have to show these kids that we're not fucking around. We have
exactly
to show them.
And they're even, like, even though the teacher, their ninth grade teacher, was a very minor character himself, we see a scene where, like, a really subtle scene where he's playing in the back playing in the back with his student. He's basically socializing with them in a very normal way, might I mention, socializing with them, and he sees the military crew, outside the window of the bus, and he, you could see him look a little uneasy of what's going on, why are we here, where are we going, you know.
I'm pretty sure he was in the know for the actual game, because you'd have to be. What they do is, for people who don't know, the game itself, the titular Battle Royale, is selected through random lottery, where every year a new class would be selected to take part in this game.
But didn't Kitano say that he wasn't cooperating, hence why he was killed?
We don't know exactly when he starts to resist the government's implementation of this game, but mm-hmm. yeah, he tried to protect their students and his students, and he paid for it.
Oh yeah. Stick up for youth, you're gonna get yourself killed. Those nasty youth.
Yeah, because that's what this film's about. It shows like the depths of what kids are capable of, and mm-hmm. when given a dose of reality like this, when the exterior pressures of the government start to enclose on them and puts them into the scenario where they can't get out, how will they react? And that's, I think we should get into that right now. What's so great about this film is mm-hmm. we have 42 characters.
Yes.
And we see throughout the film how everyone has a different experience in this game. Despite being an elderly director at this point, he knew how to divide himself with this massive cast, with this bolstering mm-hmm. big idea of a battle royale and where to go with it.
Mm-hmm. Everybody has a different coping mechanism, and we're even able to see that in the very, very beginning as well. When he first kills the poor little girl, I'm talking about Kitano killing the poor little girl,
yep.
We see everybody else run away, run towards something. The two little lovebirds who had a shinju, or a double suicide,
yep.
later on, they're hugging each other. They're like, we can tell right away, okay, they want to protect each other, they are a couple, what's going to happen to them?
No, the narrative is so layered, especially in that beginning, because to send them out into the game, the video instructor who's like on the wheel and cart video,
mm-hmm. and might I add, she has like the cutesiest anime voice.
Oh, she is wonderful.
While explaining something so effing morbid,
what a tone setter that is! Just like this bubbly princess character saying like, "Hey, you're all gonna kill each other! Yay!
Minasan, yoke, minasan, dekimasu ka?" 聞こえますか? お姉ちゃんが説明します? Like that.
Am I gonna have to bleep that?
if you so need to, Chris. I mean, this is our first time.
So yeah, like when they're sending out all the students into the game, you can see like they all react differently when they're getting their packs, which way the game is set up, they are given a pack that has survival supplies and a random weapon to make sure that the game isn't rigged, so to speak.
The original Fortnite, everybody.
We'll get into that. We have to close out with that because I just want to air my frustrations there. But yeah, like when they're receiving their packs and setting it out, because Fukusaka is a great director, he shows that like everyone has their own way of expressing themselves. Akamatsu, the first one to receive his pack, he stumbles over himself. He
screams.
Yeah, he screams. He's terrified. Mm-hmm. The next boy who comes up, he like triumphantly holds his pack above his head. It's like, I've got this.
Mm-hmm.
We see one of the girls who's going to commit. Was it Shinji?
Shinju.
Yeah. We see one of them, she throws her pack back at Kitano in, like, an act of defiance.
She's like, F you, and F this program.
Shogo, he just runs up to the front and then comes back for the proper pack that he was supposed to get because he knows a shotgun's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Kuriyama, just the villain of the film, essentially, casually strolls up to the front, gets his pack, and then just casually strolls away because he's in command here.
He doesn't utter a word of dialogue, yet he's great. He has a nice face.
He is an imposing figure. He is like a legendary villain of Japanese cinema, I would go so far to say.
I very much appreciate his face and presence in this film. I will say that.
He's terrifying.
Oh yeah, terrifying, but at the same time, isn't it just a little cuddly?
No,
cuddly and sexy in a way, I find.
No, I mean, like, he is...
I mean, he's terrifying, yes, but that is hot as hell.
Oh, you got a type, I understand.
I quite adore Ando, who plays Kiriyama.
Yeah, Kiriyama is, like, an outlier to the group of 42 students itself, because him and Shogo are not in the class itself.
Yes.
Shogo was a previous winner of the game who was brought back to rig the game itself, because the government's corrupt, guys. I don't know if you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And Kiriyama is a volunteer, actually. He is a straight psychopathic, sociopathic monster who says, yeah, I'll take part. This sounds like fun.
Yay, killing kids!
And he does very well.
He does extraordinarily well, and it is terrifying. Every time you see his face before he shoots, you could see the, you could see the soullessness in his eyes.
The soullessness and the glee.
Soullessness, glee, but also, do you remember the final scene where they give him white contacts?
Yeah, he runs into Shinji's group, who's trying to, who hacked the government's computer system and are trying to blow up the school where mm-hmm. Kitano and the SDF is
basically destroying any chance of the students having a victory over the government in that moment.
Yeah, resistance. Yeah, they get too enthusiastic and think that our main character, Shuya, is coming to join them. It's actually Kiriyama who guns them down mm-hmm. quite effortlessly.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that... causes an explosion, and the layers of fire that we then see a fight between Kawada and Kiriyama between layers of fire, and you could see the insanity in Ando's face when he acts out his final battle with Kawada, because he knows this is the guy he has to kill in order to basically win the program.
Yeah, I said it before, these are like the anime characters. These are like anime archetypes. You have Shogo, who's the super cool hero guy who's overly prepared and completely perfect at everything he does.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Kiriyama, who is this unreadable, evil sociopath. And that whole scene is just... it's a stylistic overload.
I could watch that scene over... I swear I'm not psychotic, but I could just watch that scene over and over for the pure art of it. But speaking of Kawada's previous win and how he's portrayed as the anime hero archetype, you'll note that in the very, very beginning of the film, we see the so-called previous winner of the Battle Royale the year before, and it's a little girl holding a creepy little doll smeared with blood, and she looks psychotic as heck. Yet she is the previous winner. But she's not seen as... She's not portrayed as the so-called hero that Kawada... The so-called hero treatment that Kawada got, you know?
Yeah, because every... like we were saying, everyone reacts to this game differently. But what's so amazing about that intro scene is just like, what a tone setter for your movie.
Exactly.
So you have this idea going into it, what Battle Royale is about. It's about kids killing each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing you see is a news media circus. So first off, telling you that people know about this thing. This isn't like a secluded event. This is news media. This is an event.
This is something that people don't protest against.
Well, we don't see that, but at the same time, people report on this. This is like common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the girl who is younger than any of the other contestants that we see. So this can happen to younger students.
I think she's the same age. She looks a lot younger because she's carrying a little dolly and has braces.
I think it's for third year middle schoolers.
Factually, it is for third year middle schoolers. They choose a third year middle school class for every year. So, so she is the same age as the other 42 students that we see, but she does look much, much younger, especially with the way they have given her the prop of the little doll and her braces and her, she has chubby cheeks. She does appear a lot. She looks like Nevada Tan.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
And just so the people know, for a third year middle school student, what is the average age for that?
15.
15. So yeah, R15 rating. 15-year-old characters on screen. Can't watch it.
Exactly. Ironic all the way around. Now, what I kind of want to discuss is, like, the taboo topics that the movie discusses. And one taboo topic in particular that struck out with me, and I'm sorry, Chris, I gotta talk about it, but do you remember the scene where... Oh, God, what was her name?
Mitsuko and Hirono. And yes, we've got into this before, and yes, this is a great scene.
This is a scene that I think really struck out to me, especially for an early 2000s film in Japan, where Hirono's a woman, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Hirono basically says she found a used tampon in the toilet. She checked Megumi to see if she had her period.
Megumi is a body found at the same location that she is confronting Mitsuko.
Yes, and realized that she does not have her period. Now it must be Mitsuko on her period. And the whole mention of the period and the whole visual cue of, with that dialogue alone, you automatically get a vision like, oh my god, she actually checked her for something that kind of nasty and weird, like... That piece of dialogue alone struck out to me so much. But then, of course, with patriarchy, because everything patriarchy, and of course Japan patriarchy, if you heard the recent news about the Tokyo Medical School, they get into an argument about a boy. They get in.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, everybody like has like their own little love story going on, and it's all about jealousy and like toxic masculinity. But what? What struck me the most here is that a lot of the female fights mostly had to do with boys.
Yeah, like because again, we're just like taking a middle school class, uprooting it, and just throwing them into this game.
Hormone palooza.
Exactly. So it's an outlet for all of these like welled up emotions that they have to just go freely upon each other. For example, there's that, Mitsuko and Hirono, and how they finally work out their power dynamic. There's also one of the hardest ones to watch, at least from a male perspective, Chigusa and Nida.
yes, no. I'll spare you the action of, like, I'll spare you the pain that you're about to feel when I describe what happens here.
Dick stabbing.
Yes, dick stabbing, maybe dick slicing, but... basically, poor Nida gets his manhood. He ain't able to make babies, and he dead.
Yeah, like, let's not say poor Nida, because he takes this game as an opportunity to finally,
he wants to manipulate her into sex, and I actually wrote down here the word shoujo. Now, the word shoujo is used, for our subtitles, it was used as the word virgin, which, yes, technically correct. But the word shoujo itself basically just means little girl. It means basically prepubescent little girl. So the fact that he wants to, like, the fact that he believes that her womanhood is based on being a virgin, you know, he decides to basically give her some mental gymnastics and really try and manipulate her, but she ain't having any of it.
No, because like we were saying, like, this game allows these students to be who they really would be, because now the gloves are off. It gives your only chance to be who you are. And Nida takes it as an opportunity to force himself on someone, to, like, hold that power over a woman, and he wasn't prepared for Chikusa to defend herself, and it goes very poorly for him.
Absolutely, and that's honestly what I'm going to say it. That was one of my favorite scenes, because that was such a, I guess, female, like, such a powerful scene for to see the male who was behaving poorly in this context
get his comeuppance.
I don't want to say get what he deserved, but he got what he deserved.
He got what he deserved. You don't do that, especially even with the circumstance. Like, you can't just throw that to a girl and said, "Hey, no, you can't."
Arguably, he is young and he is taking his social cues from, you know, adults in his life at this point in his life, or like,
and the circumstances,
and media. So, I do think like this scene in particular does kind of give a stab at the media that does prefer the you know, the macho male archetype, you know, the one that gets the woman and has the sex.
Exactly, but this whole scene is wonderfully shot too. It's pretty much all in one unbroken handheld take of their struggle together, and then eventually Chigusa gets the upper hand, several slashes to the back, throat, and genitals, and And then after all that, after she's, like, living in what she did, like, realizing the action she just pulled against, the camera rack focuses out, and we see Mitsuko in the background.
Oh, yeah.
Who has been witnessing this whole thing, gives her trademark devilish smile, and then just guns down Chigusa. Like, this is a completely unhinged game that we're taking part in.
Now, was Kill Bill released before or after this?
Was what?
Kill Bill released before or after this?
After.
After, okay.
Yeah, we should also get into that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Tarantino talked this movie up big time. He's probably the reason, I don't want to give it all to him, but he's probably the reason why you can find, like, a copy of Battle Royale at a Sunrise Records here.
Yeah, but, basically his promotion and his influence, like, you could see it all throughout Kill Bill. It's very obvious that Mitsuko was the basis for, what's her face?
The schoolgirl?
Yeah.
Or Oren Ishii. Which one are you talking about?
The one with the sword.
That's Oren Ishii. The schoolgirl character has the ball and chain.
Yes. Okay, so yeah. Oren Ishii, because I have not seen Kill Bill. But,
You know what? You're fine. Like, yeah. It's a great movie, but no one's, like, twisting your arm here.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm very far behind with, very important popular culture, but yeah, like, I do think that the I guess the combination with the Kill Bill, is it a trilogy now?
No, it was just two films.
It was just two films, okay. So the combination of the Kill Bill movies kind of go really hand in hand with Battle Royale, with the femme fatale character and the Japanese schoolgirl, violent little Japanese schoolgirl archetype there.
Also, do you want your mind blown right now?
Let's hear this.
The actress who played Takao Chigusa, Shiaki Kuriyama.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's... Oh, my... Okay, yes.
There you go, yeah.
Yes, okay.
She played Gogo, that's the character's name, in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yes. Hats off to her, you know?
Yeah, she got a brief... She got an iconic role in the West, so she's fine. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Tarantino, like, I'm frustrated with him a lot because of his culture vulturing he constantly does. But he talked a big game when it came to Battle Royale. He really held it up on a flagpole and said, we should really be checking this movie out.
Yeah.
It's also what I like about this film. I don't know about you, but this was the first time I ever saw that very Japanese touch of the blood fountain from a wound.
Are you talking about when Nobu was slashed?
There's that. There's when Mitsuko slashes Noriko's best friend. There is...
Megumi.
There is when Shogo Kawada blasts Kuriyama's necklace off and it detonates. Just that effect of, like, a fountain of blood erupting from a wound. This is the first time I've ever seen that in any media.
Really?
Back when I watched this in 2004, like, that was completely foreign to me. Like, that.
You just watched this in 2004. You were 10. Were you not?
Oh, yeah, I guess it wasn't. I was 12, so it was 2006 then.
Oh, my lord.
Like, you find this. I found it a copy of it, and I just could not believe what I was witnessing.
I mean, you of all people, I would be most... Not, like, I'm not surprised that you watch it, but at the same time, I feel like you could handle it better at 12, whereas I would probably have vomited. Side note, fun fact, I have physically vomited at a scene in a movie that Chris has suggested, so...
Oh, we don't need to get into that.
Yeah, congratulations, Chris, you know.
That was a Korean film. This is not a Korean film podcast.
I mean, you know, but that just gives you a look at what kind of human Chris is.
That movie, by the way, listener, was I Saw the Devil, and it is an amazing movie that you should all watch.
And maybe skip a certain scene.
Or watch that scene completely, because it's a good movie. No. You're not going to win this.
No. Mint, where are you? Okay.
So I also wanted to get into this little tidbit, going back to Fukasaka's career.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about this film is, like I said before, it's the, like, apotheosis of his career. And it's actually, like, him letting out this internalized frustration he has with the government, which has been represented throughout his entire filmography. But here it is at its most potent, because this idea of watching your friends die, that is taken from real life, from his, like, personal experience.
Was he drafted to the war, or...?
No, during the last year of the war, he worked at a munitions factory that was bombed by the United States.
Oh.
And he's claimed in interviews that he literally had to hide under his friends' bodies in order to survive.
Oh, so, my goodness.
So that frustration, like, towards a government who had let that happen, has been constantly represented throughout his entire, like, every film that is slightly critical of the government. But here it is at its most explicit, at its most, like, aggressive, and at its most, I'd say, potent, because it's through the eyes of what he was like at that age way back when.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like, it was a point that I made, like, in a review, an essay I wrote about this movie, actually, back in university, is that, like, he's essentially dramatizing his own radicalization. Like, this is where all that frustration comes, like, from his films, like, all directed at, like, an ineffectual government who was trying to reconstruct Japan after the, atomic bomb drops.
Right.
So this is, like, him showing, going back to that, young man that he once was, who saw the failures of his own government and just putting it for a new generation, like a swan song, essentially, because it's the last film, just saying, like, this is my message to the youth of the world: be vigilant, be angry, and be strong, because the government is not going to be friendly to you or understand your perspective.
Exactly. And, like, one of the things that really struck out to me is that in the beginning I was actually wondering, is this a youth problem? Are they actually going to be emphasizing the youth problem the same way they did with the Japanese Nouvelle Vague trend or era of Japanese film? Because, you know, with stories like Cruel Story of Youth, Crazed Fruit, you know, it really emphasized the youth problem. And I was wondering, will, like, especially having now been detached from the book, at the very beginning I was like, is this going to be... back to those crazy youth, those annoying crazy youth kind of problem. But then as the story progresses, you, especially when you get, like, an individual psychological feel for all of the characters and their own way, like, their own mechanisms of coping, which really essentially humanizes every single character involved.
You feel every death. It all matters. Mm-hmm. Like, these aren't just bodies. They are people. They have names, they have numbers, they're it matters.
Yeah. And, like, it also prompts me to ask questions that I never would have been able to ask, like, should I have been in that situation, would I have killed my friend? Would the what was that psychological experiment with the prisoners and the guards, and they do you know about that psychological experiment?
Yeah, like, I forget the actual name, like Stafford or Stanford prison
experiment? The Stanford prison experiment where a couple of people were designated as the guards and then a couple of people were designated as the prisoners. And because those people that were the guards were able to use their authority any way they wanted, the prisoners in return retaliated, and it caused a bunch of deaths. And basically the experiment itself was kind of nasty. But it also prompts you to realize, like, had I been in this situation, would I have been able to rebel against the authority, or would I have been cowardly, so to say, or not even cowardly, would I have been able to shoot my friend for the sake of my own survival? And it was one of my thoughts when I was reading the book in the beginning as well, should I and my sisters have been on this island, what would I have done?
It's a very hard question to grapple with, especially, like, this is, that's the essence of a lot of Fukasaka films, is this idea of conflict between an isolated group of characters under a pressure imposed from outside, like, a completely artificial pressure that shouldn't be thrust onto them, but is nonetheless. And that's a really fun experiment to think about, like, how would I do if this were happening to my class at 15? I'd personally go down like a bitch, but...
at 15 years old, but also, like... You think of your you also think of your life at 15 as well. Like, at 15, you know, I was at maybe the peak of my friendships, I guess, so to say. I wasn't as bullied as I was maybe in previous years. So would I have been able to, like, put that aside? You know, would I have been able to still confront my bullies, you know? It brings all that, like, psychological trauma or anything, so to say, from middle school back to you, and it kind of puts you in a place where you think about your own existence in relation to everybody else's existence. Does my existence matter to me more than the existence of the people in my life who make me me?
That's why it was so important for Fukasaga to say, like, kids should be watching this film, because they need to know, like, if given the similar circumstances, what were their priorities be? And again, just going back to how great,
yes,
how well this movie is written, we see, like, the gambit of, like, the complete deck of how all these different characters deal with it. We have, for example, Shinji, who takes it upon himself and, like, his radical grandfather to try and overthrow the game and build a bomb and hack the government. But then we have, like, people like Hiroki, who just wants to confess his love to the girl he likes. Aww. Like, and we just see, like, on both poles, like, mm-hmm, how we can all go about this game differently. Some people find it as a way to work through their traumatic backstory, like Mitsuko, mm-hmm, who just unleashes it on the world, or mm-hmm, Shuya, who internalizes it and tries to protect someone.
I also want to, like, go into a bit of, like, the essence of Japanese nostalgia and how they kind of internalize their own nostalgia as adults. Because the concept of seishun, or youth, is something that's really looked back upon for Japanese adults as, like, a time of pure bliss. We see that, like, pure bliss kind of feeling in the bus when they're all exchanging cookies and, you know, playing little clapping games and stuff like that.
Like, this is a moment they'll never have again.
Exactly. And it kind of, like, if anything, when they see their own seishun attacked, their own youth attacked in this way, you know, that's where the Japanese adult, so to say, has their own psychological questions to ask as well, you know?
It's the failure of the adult class to take care of the youth. This, like, it, again, going back to Fukasaga in that munitions factory, that's the exact idea that he was talking about. Like, my youth, like this has corrupted me. Like,
yes.
I now have an enemy in the form of the government, which I once assumed protected me.
Absolutely. And I think we're doing pretty well on time, but one last thing I want to talk about. Can we talk about how iconic this soundtrack is?
Yes. The theme to the song that hits you right away, it completely sets the tone perfectly. It is a thumping classical chorale, and yeah, you feel the urge, mm-hmm, going into this movie.
And, like, that theme song is used in quite a lot. It's actually used in a lot of Japanese variety shows, and honestly, nowadays, I've seen it, like, be used for, like, very comical instances, actually. One example is back around, actually around the same time Battle Royale was released, so when Morning Musume was on a TV show, basically one of the smaller members got, like, picked up by a large man, and they were using that theme song as he was approaching her. So, the themes, like, but here's the thing. When I was watching the film, even after all this Morning Musume stuff, after, and detaching myself from the book, that theme song, I forgot it was used in comical instances.
Yeah, and that's, by the way, the theme song is going to be closing out this episode, so.
Oh, hell yes!
And that song, by the way, is Requiem Dies Irae by Giuseppe Verdi, conducted by Masamichi Amano.
Okay. I hope that people understood that. We good.
Yeah, it's a well-known track.
Okay. I kind of want to download it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably on Spotify under, like, some conductor's personal page.
It'll get you hyped up. It'll either get you hyped up for your exam or give you extreme anxiety about it.
Like, I'm gonna put this on my, like, running playlist, because why not?
Oh, hell yes.
Just imagine Kuriyami is chasing me with a submachine gun.
Yes, Chris, actually, that is fantastic motivation for me to run. I ran this morning, and I did not have that, so...
Exactly, you could go farther, faster, and...
Marathon, bitches!
Oh, and just one final note about the film's release. Obviously, there was a huge attempt to ban the film, fearing the effects of the film's abundant violence would have on impressionable young minds.
Mm-hmm.
This film is not encouraging kids to do this. It's a very negative portrayal of this idea, of this concept.
Yes, and that goes back into the whole violent video games kind of argument, where is it the video games that are making the kids, are these school shootings happening because of video games? No. Like, spoiler, no.
No, yeah, but, like, that's been going on forever, that whole discourse since Columbine brought it to the forefront. Mm-hmm. But speaking of
video games,
yeah, like,
yes,
you know exactly
you.
Where I was going with that. So I don't like to talk to the young people who are assumed to be listening to us, because we are above the age of the average podcast listener now.
Are we?
That's a sobering thought, yeah, but it's true.
Oh, okay. I don't listen to podcasts unless there's celebrities on them, so more than likely I'm probably not going to listen to this one, but anyways, go on.
Yeah, for a lot of young people, like, the idea of Battle Royale, just to show how influential this film actually is, the current trend in video games of Battle Royale games, where it's a group, a massive online multiplayer of... a group of people dropped into a isolated environment and told to kill one another.
With danger zones. The
exactly.
Storms coming in, yeah.
Like, there's no evidence, like, that's the original, like, Battle Royale game, because it's obviously a well-known genre that you could trace back to who God knows how long ago. But the influence of Battle Royale is so felt that people just assume, or just credit Battle Royale. It's like, yeah, that's where we got the idea for the game. Or that's where they must have got the idea from the game. I saw something that frustrated me so bad over the weekend. I saw a copy of Battle Royale, the novel, sitting in a bookstore, and it says, "Now read the novel that inspired the game Fortnite." Koshun Takami doesn't need that. He hasn't written another thing since Battle Royale, but at the same time, he did fine. That book sells itself.
It does. It's a masterpiece on its own, guys. Don't read it for the Fortnite.
I don't see you slapping that advertisement on Hunger Games.
Shuya's not aiming for number one victory royale, guys.
He wants to survive, get off the island, and eventually
protect his girl.
His best friend's girl.
His best friend's girl, who now has become his girl.
Because that's how it works.
Yeah. Slapping the bro code in the face.
There's no bro code. Don't.
There isn't.
No, we should have told you that. Men should have really put out a press release or something. The bro code doesn't exist. That was how you met your mother. How I met your mother. Like, propagandizing it.
Well, there goes my very inappropriate fantasies. So, I guess if anything, do you think that wraps everything up that we wanted to say?
Yeah, I think I'm well covered. Do you have anything else you want to put in about Battle Royale before we sign off?
About Battle Royale? watch the movie.
Yeah.
Watch the movie.
Honestly, find a copy of this. It's not hard. Thank you, Quentin Tarantino, I guess. Because you really should experience this. It's not hyperbole to say that it's one of the best teen films of all time.
I will say, as somebody who is squeamish, as somebody who does, like... I do vomit at the sight of blood, unnatural blood. It's something where I was able to actually appreciate the art of the of the kill scenes, rather than feeling my insides twist around because of the sight of blood.
Exactly, the idea, yeah. Like the concept, shocks you well before any of the violence on screen does.
You're prepared, yeah.
It's very stylized violence, anyway.
Mm-hmm, you're very well prepared. And you know what? We actually have not revealed the ending, so see who wins, guys.
Yeah, I guess. I won't obviously spoil it, but just so you know, in the future, we are a spoiler cast. We will talk about endings if they are significant. The ending The ending for this one is significant, but it's really much more like a sequel setup than anything.
Right, that sequel that I'm supposed to be watching soon, and it's good as a Chris said, it's good as a standalone film on its own. The sequel, I mean. So
I mean, you have a case where the original director shot one scene with Takeshi Kitano, then died, and then his son, who was like again the original scriptwriter, got his first directorial job, and it's very much a amateur directorial job. It's like a debut through and through, but at the same time, it's fine. It's not going to set the world on fire like Battle Royale did. At the same time, though, it's not supposed to. It's its own thing. It has nothing to do with like the actual chronology of the book or any of the ideas in there. It's its own little thing, and it's fine. But you don't have to actually watch it.
No, that's absolutely true.
We won't be covering it on the podcast. We will not be covering it on the podcast.
Not yet, at least, and not for a very long time, but.
I hope we have more content than instantly going to a sequel.
We won't. We will have more content, but should we be doing this maybe for who knows how long? Maybe I would say a year. You know, it would be nice to revisit it.
How about like a anniversary special? Like
absolutely. See, if we get there, I mean,
planning ahead isn't bad. But like just thinking, like see how far we came from that original enthusiastic thing before this becomes a job for us.
Exactly, and. Is this where I offer to take my top off, or...?
No. They can't see that, Arupa. We've been over this.
Well, too late. My top is off.
Well, great, because I can't even see that. It's a Skype call without any picture, so... So that's going to wrap it up from us here at Eigen Knight. Make sure to follow us on all the things. Twitter, at Eigen Knight. Facebook...
At Eigen Knight.
Eigen Knight. I'm sorry. Facebook, Eigen Knight Podcast. You can find our WordPress where we're going to be uploading all the episodes, eigennightpodcast.wordpress.com. And yeah, that's going to do it for us.
Follow us on Twitter for any updates on all of our content. And really, thank you for listening, because I probably would not have listened.
Well, that's a bit harsh. But yes, I am at Cinema Creep on Twitter. Aruba, you're in the middle of putting up a new Twitter account.
I am, yep. Without further ado, thank you so, so much, everybody, for actually listening to this. And thank you, Chris, for setting this up.
No problem. And hey, everyone at home, take care.
All right. See you later, guys. Bye.